Okay, well, welcome to part three of Kabbalah, Genesis and Exodus. And I do have to say that we're only scratching the surface of these incredible books. And I really do think they're incredible books. A lot of people look at the Hebrew Testament and say that it's nasty and brutish, but it's about humanity. It's actually about who we are. And it has such lessons in it for us. It's incredibly relevant for today. Basically, they all behave fairly badly, but we all do. And they are works in progress. These are very young parts of humanity. And the patriarchs and matriarchs are highly honored in Judaism. And there are quite a few commentaries about the women in particular, which are fairly negative, but that's very much of the times. But these were very human people who made a lot of errors, and that's one of the reasons why they are so important. Okay, somebody hasn't muted. Would you be kind enough, please? There's a sound of footfalls and possibly a dog in the background, so... it's Michelle. I will mute her. Right. OK, so let's get going. So this is all about the calling, and it's mainly about Abraham and his wives and his descendants. And on that first page is one of the deep, wonderful secrets of the Hebrew Bible. It's one of the things that was highlighted in the movie and the book The Secret, where she said that these things were hidden in the Bible. They're hidden in plain sight. All the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring forever. And that's the Lord speaking to Abraham. But we're not meant to read it just literally. This is one of the reasons, and it is repeated, that the land will be Abram's forever. And one of the reasons why there is still war, essentially, between Israel and Palestine over Jerusalem and the land there, because the Zionists say, this is my land, and therefore God gave it to me, therefore I must fight for it. Well, yes, that's so, but actually this saying is much deeper than that. Much deeper, because the word that is used as see is ra'au, means perceive as well as see. So that's important to know, that it's all the land, all the physical things that you can perceive, I will give to you and your offspring forever. In the modern world, we call this the law of attraction. It's actually resonance. What the Lord is saying to Abraham is, where you put your focus is what you receive. And that's a very important lesson for all of us. And it's quite clear throughout the whole of the Hebrew Testament that when people put their focus on the Holy One, they put their focus on God, if you like, they put their focus on what is good and whole, then things work out well for them. And this is also mentioned in Deuteronomy, which is one of the later books. It's part of the Torah. It's allegedly the book that was found in the Hebrew temple before it was reformed. And it goes, I call heavens, it's plural, by the way. Nowhere in the Bible is heavens singular. They always knew it was heavens, which is really interesting. Now we know the multitude of galaxies that there are in the universe. Well, we still don't know them, but we know that there are two galaxies for every living human being on this planet that we know of. That's a lot of galaxies, so that's a lot of heavens. But Deuteronomy says, I call heavens and earth to record this day on your behalf that I've placed before you life and death, blessing and cursing. So choose life that you and what you sow may live or be restored. And this theme goes all the way through the Hebrew Testament and into the New Testament as well, which is choose life, choose blessing, because the opposite is death. There is no stasis. Everything either grows or decays. And the Holy One is always calling us to choose the blessings and the life. So Genesis reflects the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are on the Tree of Life as placed there by Warren Kenton, my teacher, and they work from the top down to the bottom. But even though the story of Abraham takes place before the giving of the Ten Commandments to Moses. A lot of the Genesis is imputed, it is believed that it was dictated to Moses by God. It was seriously edited. I'm quite sure it was divinely inspired because it's so beautifully structured around the menorah from beginning to end, beautifully structured around the tree, but it has been edited. And in Abraham's story, there is clear evidence of this editing. So human changes have affected the sense in many ways, and we don't have the absolute beauty of the flow of it. We have something that's quite good enough, but it's not the original. And Genesis is all about the ego. In fact, it's the building of the ego of humanity, and the ego is not bad. We're taught that it's bad, but the ego is how we respond, react to life. It's our patterns. And of course, Kabbalah is all about the patterns of creation. And this is how humanity formed itself, how it learnt to live on the planet. And your ego is the part of you that keeps you breathing when you're asleep, remembers how you walk, remembers how to speak, remembers what you've been taught, remembers which plant is safe to eat and which plant is not. The ego is utterly vital for life. It's only relatively recently that we've had the leisure and the information to make our egos far more destructive than they ever have been before in the history of humanity. And ego is also all about tribe. It's about family and tribe. And we can tell how important family is if we watch EastEnders on British TV. It's all about family. But family is very important. And certainly when you are a small nation that is building itself, you have to honour your tribe and stay with your tribe. And the patriarchs and matriarchs demonstrate perfectly what happens when you keep the commandments and when you break the commandments around Yesod. And the commandments around Yesod are do not covet, which is basically do not be jealous, do not envy, do not want that which is not free to be given to you. Because if you're choosing life, what is available to be given to you will be given to you. Do not bear false witness. Do not steal and do not commit adultery. We know that do not murder probably applies to Cain and Abel as well. But the patriarchs particularly are showing us how humanity built its tribal consciousness and the errors and the wonders that they did. And karma is clearly discernible throughout the book of Genesis. So we start off with Abraham and Sarah. They were originally called Abram and Sarai, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes' time. And oddly enough, the first thing Abram does is disobey God. Oh, it's the Lord, it's not God, it's Yahweh. Now the Lord said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house to a land that I will show you. It's very clear. Go away from your family. Start again. So what does Abram do? He takes his nephew Lot with him. Now, he will have done it for all the loving family reasons. Lot will have wanted to come with him. But the Lord was very clear, don't do it. Go with your wife and start a new nation. But he doesn't. He takes Lot with him. And guess what? Lot is basically nothing but trouble. And we've all had that experience, I know. Not necessarily that the Lord speaks to us, but we have this little intuition, which is don't do this, don't take that. And we don't follow it. And later on we go, oh, I wish I had. And the problems with spiritual work and family is that family aren't necessarily on the same level as you. And anybody in spiritual work will know that quite awful moment, actually, awful in both ways, awful as in terrifying, but awful as in wondrous, when you realise you're not speaking the same language as your family anymore. You're actually more in contact with divinity and your life is being directed from above. And your family will not understand that and they will resent it. So Abram and Lot travel together. And they do very well. I mean, Abram was basically a cattle millionaire. He thrived, and so did Lot, but the land could not support the two of them. So therefore, they had to split up. Abraham's people, his servants, his slaves, and Lot's people, those servants and his slaves, were quarrelling all the time over the land and over where they could graze their cattle and where they could water their cattle. So Abram said to Lot, "Let there be no quarrelling between us. So let us separate ourselves out, and you go to the left and I'll go to the right. But if you go to the right, then I'll go to the left." So Abram is a really good, conciliatory man. Abram always means well. So Lot and he divide up. And the teaching about families is followed by, in the New Testament, by Jesus when he's asked about his family. And he says, "My mother and my brothers are those who hear God's word and put it into practice. They're not your blood relatives. If you're very blessed, they include your blood relatives. But that is not necessarily so." And of course, Abram has to rescue Lot. In fact, he has to rescue Lot twice because Lot is a blot on the landscape as far as Abram is concerned. There are four warring kings because these are all tribal times. Small barons, we would call them in England in the old days, fighting each other, going backwards and forwards over land. And four warring kings united and they invaded the towns of Sodom and Gomorrah. And they took all the people and the animals captive. Now, Abram knows that his nephew is in Sodom. So he mobilizes all his people and his troops and he goes on the attack and he wins the fight. He rescues all the animals and all the people and he brings them back safely out. And the king of Sodom says, "Well, give me the people of Sodom and keep all the goods for yourself." But Abram says, "I've raised my hand," which means I've given my word, "to the Lord God Most High." That's Yahweh El Elohim. And this is interesting because this is the first indication of a split text. Because El Elohim was the formal title of God in the other text, in the E text, which is earlier than the Y text. So they've tried to meld these texts, and most of the time it works very well. Occasionally it gives us a few hiccups, but just knowing why the hiccups are there can help us to comprehend it much better. So Abram says, "I've given my word to the Lord God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, that I will take nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or the strap of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, 'I made Abram rich.'" Now this is Abram's integrity. He's making quite sure that the Holy One gets all the credit for what Abram is receiving and what is happening for him. So it's a beautiful thing, and it shows that he is completely ungreedy as well. And yet, what's interesting is that in the middle of all this kerfuffle, we have the first covenant of bread and wine. It's in the middle of the story of the retaking of Sodom. So it sort of rings a bit of a jarring bell, but it's a beautiful piece of writing about a man called Melchizedek. Now, a Zedek is a righteous one. A Melchizedek is said to be one of the eternal beings like Enoch. And he's called King of Salem. And of course, Jerusalem comes from Salem. So it's basically a king of the holy place, a representative of the Holy One. And it says he was priest of God Most High. So this is El Elohim, not Yahweh, El Elohim. And he blesses Abram, saying, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth." And Abram then gives him a tithe of all. So a tithe, in modern terms, is always taken as meaning a tenth. And it was a tenth of your produce. It was never a tenth of money. People who only had money, like merchants, were excused from the tithing system. But the idea was you gave a tenth. If you had 20 lambs, 20 sheep, it would be 2 lambs. If it was your increase, only your increase. If you were in profit, you had more corn or more sheep or more goats or more cattle, you gave a tenth of the increase. So you had 10 lambs that year, which was more 10 more than last year, you would give one lamb. You would always work it out by one whole thing. The tenth was never divided. So you would never give a leg of a lamb or do anything that was to cut anything up. And you would give a certain amount of wheat. So a tenth in those days could also mean one whole thing, as opposed to the mathematical tenth, because let's face it, a lot of people weren't numerologically literate or literate in any way. So it's a wonderful way of saying you put whatever inspires you first. The text says give it to God, but one of the ways you give to God is by giving to people who inspire you. And Melchizedek has come and said, this is the sacrifice that honours the Holy One. So we can tell this is an e-text. It's been saved because it works so beautifully, and it's a sign that Abram is in high favour. But it's definitely an e-text. Now, there's a lot of long stories, and I'm not going to be able to tell all of them, and they're not going to come to you in actual chronological order, because I love that picture of Sarah there that I found from the internet. Abram, Sarah, and the fear of the other. This is very natural to all humanity. We all fear what we perceive to be an enemy, and we will defend ourselves. Now, Abram, Sarah, and fear of the other happens twice. The first story is all about Yahweh, the Lord, and the second story is all about Elohim and God. So we don't know if this story did happen twice or whether it was just told in two different ways. But we'll tell the story twice because it has the emphasis. Basically, there was a famine. So, as happens later in Genesis again, Abram took his family down into Egypt, where there was land. And when he went down to Egypt, he started getting worried because the rules and regulations down in Egypt meant that Pharaoh had what we would call in the Middle Ages in Europe, droit de seigneur, which means he had the right to take any woman he pleased. And Abram was afraid, because Sarah was so beautiful, that Pharaoh would want to take her. So he says to Sarah, say you're my sister. And therefore, if Pharaoh wants to take you, he won't punish me, he won't hurt me. So when the Egyptians see you, they will kill me if they think I am your husband. So Sarah agrees, and Pharaoh's Egyptians officials saw Sarah and took her straight into the palace for Pharaoh. And Pharaoh treated Abram well. He bought Sarah from him, in fact, for sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, men servants and maid servants, and camels. But the Lord wasn't having any of that. The Lord inflicted a plague on Pharaoh and his family for taking Sarah, because Sarah was innocent. And so Pharaoh summons Abram and says, what's going on? Why didn't you tell me she's your wife? I would not have taken her if you have told me. And this is one of the Bible's first intimations that the other can also be honourable. And it's an important thing for the ego to learn. There's a lot of fighting in the Hebrew Testament, and of course there's the Roman invasion which has taken place for the New Testament, and very often the enemy is something to be feared, but not always. The enemy may not be your enemy. The other is not necessarily meaning you harm. And Abram admitted that Sarah was his wife, and Pharaoh gave orders to say, you can take her home, and they let Abram keep all the gifts. Now, that's an act of extreme generosity. And in the modern world, we would judge Abram for that, because basically he's prostituting his wife to save his soul, save his skin. But that's what Yesod does. He's showing us the level of fear we all have. And I don't know about you, but I have lied to save my skin many a time in my life. And this story is warning us that the other may very well forgive us and watch over us, but it isn't wise. And now this happens again later in the story when a different king, Abimelech, This is the story with the Elohim in it, not Yahweh, and Abimelech, king of Gerar, saw Sarah, sent for her, and took her because Abraham said again, she's my sister. But God came to Abimelech in a dream and said, you're as good as dead because of the woman you've taken. She's a married woman. And Abimelech, I can't pronounce that, can I? Hadn't gone near her. So he said, Lord Adonai. Lord Adonai. So that's the respectful title that you would give to somebody else's God, actually. Would you destroy an innocent nature? Did he not say to me, she is my sister? And did she not also say, he is my brother? I've done this with a clear conscience and clean hands. And God said to him in the dream, yes, I know you did this with a clear conscience. And so I have kept you from sin. That is why I did not let you touch her. Now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you and you will live. But if you do not return her, you may be sure that you and all of yours will die. So the next morning, Abimelech summons all his officials and he calls Abram in and he says, what have you done to us? How have I wronged you that you've brought such guilt upon me and my kingdom? You've done things to me that should not be done. What is your reason for doing this? And Abraham confessed. And this is the fundamental honesty of this man, because he says, I did it because I was afraid. He owns up. That's something the ego doesn't like to do. So it shows that this is a man of good integrity. He said, there is surely no fear of God in this land. That's what I thought. And they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she really is my sister, the daughter of my father, though not of my mother. And she became my wife. And Abimelech lets him go and gives him more sheep and cattle and male and female slaves, and gives them to Abraham and returns his wife to him. And a brief aside here, which was in the early days, incest was acceptable because there were lots of half-brothers and half-sisters and everybody was keeping stuff in the tribe. There weren't that many people, so it was perfectly acceptable for you to marry your half-brother or half-sister, and certainly, as we see later, extremely acceptable for you to marry a cousin. However, we now know in the modern world that's one of the reasons why the biblical matriarchs were so infertile. Because if you breed too close to home, it affects the fertility of both the man and the woman. So we go Abram to Abraham and Sarai to Sarah. And these names have a little bit of a different meaning. Abram literally means exalted father. Now, Abraham isn't a father at that point. Sarah is too old to have children and she hasn't had children. And Abraham contains another unused root word which roughly means multitude. So Abraham is father of a multitude. So when God makes his covenant with Abram and changes his name to Abraham, it's acknowledgement that not only is he a father, and that will be a father to his slaves and his servants, and also to the land, he will actually physically be the father of a multitude of other human beings. Sarai to Sarah is slightly more complicated. They're generally both translated as princess, though technically Sarah means noble woman rather than princess, but we don't know any more about the meaning of the change for that. Incidentally, the legends do say that Sarah was present at that giving of the bread and wine with Melchizedek, and there is some evidence from the Septuagint that she was edited out of that story. But again, we don't know. This is all speculation. Also, God has a different name. Abram calls him the Living Almighty. The Lord Yahweh appears to Abram and says, I am the Living Almighty God, walk before me and be thou perfect or upright and sincere. And I will make my covenant between me and thee and I will multiply thee exceedingly. Now this is interesting because it's walk in advance of me, walk with my face, walk before me. If you remember, both Noah and Enoch walked with God. So God is saying to Abraham, you are elevated beyond these people. And Abram is the first great prophet. And the covenant that he makes with Abram includes circumcision. And circumcision, as we know, is the cutting off of the foreskin, which is pretty bad when you're a newborn baby and utterly, utterly agonizing when you're a full-grown man. So the fact that they went through all this, and this all comes back later in a really rather nasty way with the story of Dinah, Leah's daughter. But circumcision was the sign of the covenant. And in these days, it was literal, but it was also allegorical and metaphysical and mystical. But metaphysical and mystical quite often do meld those levels. And in Deuteronomy, it's very clear, circumcise the foreskin of your heart and be no more stiff-necked. Well, the foreskin of your heart, they didn't know that, but it's called the pericardium. And I have a dear Jewish friend who was very ill as a child with Hodgkin's lymphoma, and the treatment he had left him weak around the heart and lungs all of his life. And in his mid-50s, his pericardium filled with solid matter. Usually the pericardium is the sac that the heart rests in, and it's full of fluid. And when the pericardium hardens, it's a hard heart. So Adam has had to have his pericardium cut away because of hardness of heart. And in his case, it was anger and grief at his parents. And having gone through that and being a good Kabbalist and Jewish man, he's gone right down into it and understood it. And he has actually changed since that operation. His heart has softened. He's so much full of joy because he's accepted his own karma, that he created a hard heart, and he's working to release it. So circumcision, yes, it's for the penis, but I think it's absolutely relevant to say, do not harden your heart and do not be stiff-necked. Now, the Jewish people are very stiff-necked and self-confessed as stiff-necked, and Mordecai, in the story of Esther, is extremely stiff-necked, which is why they have the festival of Purim. So the Deuteronomist was saying, the circumcision is more than just the cutting off the foreskin of the penis. Now, that alone in those days was extremely important for health, because they did not have hot running water, they did not have regular showers or baths, and the foreskin could get very encrusted, and if it got infected, you were dead. So I just like, because I'm a Taurean, I like the fact that an awful lot of the edicts given by the Lord to Moses were very sensible for a desert people. So although circumcision was a covenant, it was also extremely wise. And also Ezekiel talks about no stranger uncircumcised in heart or nor uncircumcised in flesh shall enter into my sanctuary. So it's basically about, where do you need to cut back something which brings dirt or can possibly bring poison into your life? So it works on very many levels here. I put the picture of the Tree of Life there. Warren Kenton put Zeb Ben Shimon Halevi is his Hebrew name under which he wrote. He's put the gods on the tree. I'm not quite sure I agree with it, but I don't know better than Warren. So those are the names of the of God on the tree. He's put Yahweh at the Chokmah inspiration position and Elohim as the Binah position, because that's the divine mother, the dark mother. So that does work really quite well. But then the God of mercy is El Elohim, and Yah also appears in the Hebrew Testament as the God of judgment. And Yahweh Elohim in the centre is the balancing point of all these aspects. Elohim Zeveot and Yahweh Zeveot means the hosts of, so those are the angels of God, the ones that carry out his words and edicts, and we meet three of those in the story of Abraham. And El Hai Shaddai, or El Shaddai, which is the living almighty, which is what Abraham calls him, is placed at Yesod. And this is a feminine noun which brings in this idea of mothering or fathering. It's parental, and it's about saying that God is guiding Abraham as a mother and a father, as well as being the great high God. So it's saying it is a nurturing relationship, that God loves Abram deeply. So, Sarah and Hagar, oh my, oh my, oh my. I truly believe that this legend is, if this legend actually happened, it will explain the Middle East conflict because of the two children, the two eldest children of Abraham. He had many more, as Bill has pointed out, and he's going to mention it at the end. He may have had more with Hagar. He also married again after Sarah's death and had more children with Ketubah, I think it was pronounced it. However, the story is Sarah, and we'll talk about Sarah's age in a few minutes' time. Sarah, or Sarai as she is there, can't have children. The Holy One has told Abram that he's going to be the father of a nation. And at the level of the ego, we don't believe that the impossible is possible. Sarah is past menopause. She can't have children. So in a gift of love, I hope, she decides to give her maidservant Hagar to Abram. Now, Hagar was an Egyptian, so of Arabic stock. And Hagar was probably very, very young. Hagar had no choice in the matter. We have no idea whether or not Hagar wanted to go to Abraham or whatever. But in those days, frankly, that was not deemed important. Sarah gives Hagar to Abraham, and Abraham sleeps with Hagar, and Hagar gets pregnant because she is young and also because she's not related to Abram. And when Hagar gets pregnant, because she's young and because we're talking about the ego, Hagar starts strutting and behaving as in, nah, 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 I'm pregnant, you're not, I'm the winner, I'm the true wife, you're an old fart, you don't count anymore, just watch me rule over you. And Sarah, quite understandably, complains to Abram. And Sarah is mean to Hagar. Abram at that point doesn't do anything. He listens to Sarah. But Sarah is so mean back to Hagar that Hagar runs away. And the angel of the Lord sends her back. That painting was done for me for a book I wrote about the women of the Bible by a fellow Kabbalist. And I absolutely adore that picture of Hagar and the angel. It wasn't used, unfortunately, by the publisher, but I really do love it. Hagar's son Ishmael is born. So Abram has a son. And later, we'll come back to how Sarah gives birth to Isaac later, but Isaac is born. Ishmael is quite a lot older than Isaac, and he mocks him. He plays with him, and he is a big brother to him. We don't know how bad he was. My own big brother was fairly mean to me. I remember because he knew I was claustrophobic, he one day pushed me down his bed where the sheets were all tucked in and sat at the top and laughed at me. And that was big brotherhood. So that was probably what was going on. However, Sarah was very upset, complained to Abraham, and insists that Hagar and Ishmael are thrown out. Now, sometimes it's referred to as Hagar the slave is given her freedom, but it's quite clear that she is in deep trouble. She's thrown out and she's lost and she's lonely, and she basically puts her child under a bush and prays to God, because she can't bear to watch her child die of thirst and starvation. And this time the angel of God, Elohim, saves them and prospers them. And Ishmael goes on to found the Arabic nation, and Isaac founds the Hebrew nation. So again, we don't know if this is two versions of the same story very slightly differently wound together, or whether both happen. But they're both entirely exactly what you see in this day and age now with second marriages and third marriages and families. So this story is telling us about us and how we respond and how we react to the external situations. What land are we seeing? Hagar saw her elevation as mother of Abraham's first child. So she was arrogant. Sarah saw defeat. So she was angry and mean. And these are important lessons for us, and we need to be very grateful that they're there and so clear. Okay, so how come Sarah gets pregnant? Well, Abraham is visited by three angels. And again, this is a woven text because it changes the phrasing and the wording. It says he's visited by three men and then the Lord starts speaking to him. Now, it was mostly the E-text that had angels in it, because we had the angels for the first temple. So it's probable that this has been melded, because it starts off with three men visiting Abram, but then it becomes the Lord speaking to angels. But you can generally tell when it's angels, because all teachings about angels say an angel has one job. It's sent out to do one job, and there are three messages and three men. So that strongly implies in the mystical tradition that these were angels. And the promises are that the green shoots of life will be restored, which means you become fertile again. You'll become healthy and fertile. The second one is that Abraham will become the ancestor of a nation. So that means complete fecundity going down the years, and that is different from having one son or even two sons, and also that Sodom and Gomorrah are corrupt and will be destroyed. So these are the messages that come, and when they're told these messages, both Abraham and Sarah laugh. Sarah denies laughing, but they both laugh because they can't see that it's possible. Interestingly, the Talmud says that these were angels, and it was Raphael, Gabriel, and Michael. And these are three of the angels who were associated with the first temple. Raphael is the archangel of healing. Gabriel is the archangel of everything to do with the feminine, family and home and fertility. And Michael is the archangel of justice. So Raphael would be the green shoots returning, Gabriel would be the father of the nation, and Michael would be the condemning of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, Bill highlighted this last week, that Abraham intercedes with the Holy One. He says, would you destroy everyone, including all the righteous ones, because of the bad people? What if you could find 50 righteous people? Would you save the cities? And the Lord says, yes. And then Abram thinks, well, what if there's only 45 righteous people? That's still a bit mean. So he goes back to God and says, well, can I negotiate? And they absolutely negotiate with each other, which is a friendship. And this is important for us to understand, that when you are in relationship with the Holy One, you can speak backwards and forwards and you can petition. So Abraham manages to negotiate it down to 10 righteous humans between the two cities. And the Lord agrees with this. And Lot is still living in Sodom, so two angels go to visit him to warn him. One of them is to warn him, and the other one is to tell him where to go to when he flees. And the townsmen, these are the non-righteous ones, want these two foreigners, these two strangers who are manifesting as men, to be brought out to them so that they can know them. Well, you know the phrase, to know somebody in the biblical sense, and it's not going to be pleasant. And Lot, because, now this is completely inexplicable to us in the modern age, but I will put in a word in Lot's defense here, in that in those days, if somebody had eaten your salt, they were your guest and they were inviolable. You could not kill somebody who had eaten with you. That's why in later stories, when Yael kills Sisera, she is not heralded too highly because she's fed him beforehand. And it's seen as a breaking of the commandment of hospitality. So Lot is stuck between a rock and a hard place, because by the law of hospitality, he can't send those men out to be ravished by the townsmen. However, we don't take very pleasantly to the idea that he offers his two virgin daughters instead. Fortunately, these two men are angels, so they prevent the girls from being hurt. And the men are still so intent on what they want to do that they wore themselves out groping for the door. And this is relevant because The Lord keeps forgiving. How many more times will the Lord forgive? Because this was not kind to offer the two virgin daughters. But the Lord still offers Lot the means of escape. And in the New Testament, when Jesus is asked how many times will God forgive, he says 70 times seven and then again. There is no limit to the forgiveness that is available to us if we will simply move towards. So Lot really sums up the negative lower face of the tree. Abram is doing his absolute best to do the positive lower face of the tree and doing fairly well. But Lot, no, Lot is the good example of everything that is pretty selfish. Now, there are four levels of will at the bottom of the tree, which you can see there on that diagram. My will, willingness, willlessness, and willfulness. So my will is when I'm important. I'm the one, what I say goes. It doesn't matter what you say, I need to get my will done. And we see that Lot is proud, because my will is always proud, because he sits in the gate of Sodom. Now, when you sat in the gate of a city, it meant you were an elder. In the later story of Ruth, Boaz, who wants to marry her, has to go to the gate of the city to get permission to marry her, because there are maybe closer kinspeople to her, we're back to the tribe again, who would marry her. So he has to get permission. So he goes to the gate to the elders. So Lot, whom I wouldn't actually say is a natural elder, sits in the gate of Sodom. So he's got a high impression of himself. Willingness, well, willingness can be very good, but it can also be weakness. So he will offer up his daughters in order to save himself. Willfulness, now this is interesting, because when the angel, one angel goes to tell him that he's got to flee, and the other angel, goodness knows what other angel came in to save them, but maybe they got reinforcements, say where Lot needs to flee to. Go here and you will be safe, and Lot won't. And willlessness, as in will, Lot is fairly helpless in that he just gets himself into a terrible situation and waits to be rescued, and is rescued. The willless people, less people often are rescued, but they don't make themselves entirely popular. On leaving Sodom, we have the story of Lot's wife turning into a pillar of salt. That's another cause of effect thing. Salt can be purification, it certainly was in those days, or destruction. If you wanted to destroy somebody's land, you salted it. And a very good natural weed killer nowadays is salt, or salt and vinegar mixed together. You don't want to be scattering your crisps on the garden, but both of those are extremely good weed killers. So salt can purify and it can destroy. And since Paracelsus, and the invention of homeopathy, but it was Paracelsus, goodness, Middle Ages, I think, who associated with salt as the nature of holding on to the past, not being willing to move forward into the future. And the homeopathic remedy of Natrum muriaticum, is sodium chloride, which is salt. And the homeopathic remedy for somebody who was the victim of incest is Naturum fluoratum, which is sodium fluoride. So that's really very interesting. When Lot is rescued and he's alone with his two daughters without his wife, they give him wine so they can sleep with him, so that they can have children and continue the tribal line. Now, again, incest wasn't viewed then as it is right now, but this is not entirely a good idea. So they, we know, give him wine so that they can have sex with him. Whereas the story about Noah and the effervescence, that can also be interpreted as Noah is in perfect communion with the Holy One. And also, my Jewish friend Adam told me in the week, it may be that Noah was naked in the tent because he was returning to the purity state of Eden. Now, that's a bit of a leap, but it's the first mention of humanity being naked again. So we can read this on several different levels all the way through. So the children of Lot's daughters, because they do conceive, they found the Ammonites and the Moabites, both of which practice child sacrifice. So this is not a positive thing that happens. So Lot is really a bit of a pain in the backside. So Abraham and Isaac. We all know the story of Abraham taking Isaac to be sacrificed and being given the ram instead. Now, what's really important here is to understand that this was what did happen then. There was no Jewish temple. A great deal of the faiths over there relied on the burning of children to be a sacrifice to the gods. Mostly it was the eldest son. Sometimes it was the virgin daughter. So as you can see from this page, there were so many societies, and not just in the Middle East either, South Pacific, Japan, Asia, Europe, Crete, Native American, Babylon, Egypt, China, Greece, Peru. The list goes on. It was what you did in those days. And it's also just worth mentioning that the Quran believes that it was Ishmael that Abram was told to sacrifice, because Ishmael was the eldest son. But by this time, Ishmael and Hagar had long gone, so Isaac was the remaining son. However, Dr. Margaret Barker, who is the primary researcher and teacher on the differences between the two texts, who's currently living, says that this is absolutely fascinating, because God tests Abraham, the Elohim, the earlier God, the one that was existent and worshipped at the time of child sacrifice, says to Abraham, take your only son. So this is an acknowledgement that Ishmael has long gone and that Isaac is the acknowledged son. Go to the land of Moriah and offer him there for a burnt offering on one of the mountains. And Abraham, because he loves and trusts God, and because it's the fashion, it's what people do, he must always also trust that he would have more children, because he's going to be the father of the nation. So although this seems absolutely horrendous to us, that a man would sacrifice his child, A, it was normal, and B, it was what you would do if you loved your God. But what's interesting is that in this text, it's God that says sacrifice, and it's the Lord that says you don't need to, here's the ram. In the Septuagint and the earlier text, it was God, both stories. It was God who sent Abraham and tested him, and God, Elohim, who said, no, you don't need to. So the Septuagint and Dr. Barker and several earlier texts and some of the Dead Sea Scrolls make it clearer that actually Elohim was saying, we don't do that. Even though it's the norm, we Hebrew people do not sacrifice our children. In fact, we don't have to sacrifice anything, but a ram is quite acceptable. Thank you very much. So that is the post-First Temple editing, but it still works. Because Elohim is also the law and karma. Elohim, if it's placed at the place of Binah, is the place of karma. What goes around comes around. And let's face it, Hagar and Ishmael had been thrown out, and for all Abraham knew, Ishmael was dead. So the testing was a way of giving Abram back his karma to see, you may have killed your first son, are you going to give me your second? And Abram submits and does not need to do so. And it's really important that we understand that this is God saying child sacrifice is not acceptable and not required in this tradition. Though it did still continue in the Hebrew world, but only when people were worshipping the other gods. And it's entirely possible that this was brought, maybe blood or something was brought to the first temple. There's no evidence whatsoever that there was child sacrifice in the first temple, but there may have been child sacrifice outside of it. And it was finally totally banned only after the Babylonian exile. So we have a great deal to learn from these stories, and I just wanted to touch on, I didn't talk about Abram and Sarah's ages. You've probably noticed if you've read Genesis that everybody gets to an absolutely extraordinarily ridiculous age. And it is phenomenal what kind of age these people get to. And this is one of the discoveries that gave people the realization that there were two texts that needed to be investigated. Because I'm going to read you some texts that I've researched and found out from Dr. Barker and several other people. In several ancient documents, not just the Bible, these outlandishly large figures for the number of years some kings supposedly reigned in various Mesopotamian city-states and also in Genesis are to do with a range of numbers. All of the 30 people mentioned in the genealogy in Genesis chapter 5 have ages which end with the digits 2, 5, 7 or 9. Now, when I thought about that, I thought, well, so what? But if you calculate it, that eliminates half of the possible numbers. It's like seeing a list of 30 numbers that are all even. We wouldn't think for a moment that was a random distribution of numbers, because we would expect some odd numbers to be in there. And in fact, getting all 30 numbers to end with those just approved digits in a random distribution is actually 1 in 100 million. So Genesis 5 is not merely giving us a historical report. Something else is going on here. Now, the most popular opinion now, and that's all I can say to do with it, is that they were deemed important or even sacred. 7, for example, was certainly sacred. And all the numbers, all the ages of the patriarchs and the people listed in that chapter are expressed in a way in the Hebrew which references the number 60. And 60 was culturally significant because it was the number that Babylon mathematics was based on. And we still use some of this because we have 60 minutes per hour and 60 seconds per minute. And they, of course, had 360 days in the year, which didn't quite work. We now have 365. But I can't do the calculations and I wouldn't even begin to. But Dr. Barker says, by the Babylonian way of counting, where they counted months and years in different ways, she reckoned that Sarah would be 66 years old in our calculations. And that to me would fit, because I'm just coming up to 66 year old and I'm way past menopause. And if anybody said to me, you're going to be the mother of a son, I would laugh in their face right now as well. But that can make it realistic for us if we need it to be realistic. We don't need it to be realistic because these are really important methods and legends for us. Okay, so we're going to come back to that phrase from the very beginning, which is, all the land that you see I will give to you and to your offspring forever. All that you can perceive I will give to you. So when Abram sees fear and is frightened, what he fears happens, which is that Sarah will be taken from him. He alleviates it through dishonesty. And when he owns up to the kings, he is rewarded. So he is taught very clearly that honesty is the best policy. And covetousness is also very relevant, because I covet means I want what you have because I can't appreciate what I have. And it follows on that if I can't have it, you shan't have it either. And pretty much every other commandment is broken with covetousness, because we are willing to steal or lie or adulterate or even kill. We won't honour people. We won't take our rest. If we want something that has not been given to us, then we will break that commandment at so many levels. So all these stories are saying, allow the Holy One to sort it out, because the Holy One knows what he is doing. Now, Abraham's willing to sacrifice and to redeem, to intercede and to allow. These are great virtues. However, in prostituting Sarah and allowing her to expel Hagar, he's showing a weakness. He's showing that he values his own safety and comfort before integrity. And that too is a form of covetousness. But we see that Abraham learns. That is what is so important in his story. He will redeem, he will intercede, and he will learn. And that for the early humans was a really important thing to know. Okay, so that's basically this episode. And next time we're going to be looking at false witness, theft and adultery, which are beautifully exemplified in the next series of stories. And we're going to see how these stories repeat with tiny ripples in consciousness as humanity strives to grow and learn. Because the karma is handed down so beautifully and neatly. And in the modern world, we don't talk about karma anymore because neither Judaism or Christianity in the Orthodox terms acknowledges it. But it's so clear that they knew that what you perceived was what you got. What you focus on was what you received. Or in the modern terminology, thoughts create things. So I'm going to give you a little bit of homework just to contemplate. You don't have to come back with it next week at all. Just to say, where are you covetous? Where do you not appreciate what you have been given? And where is that blocking you from receiving the good that God wants to give to you? Where do you believe that what you have is not enough? Because that belief that you do not have enough is exactly what will increase the likelihood of the reality that you will not have enough. It's a term for prosperity consciousness in a way. If you feel that you are broken poor, then you will create more broken poor. And it's in literally a case of reprogramming the neural pathways to look for what you want to see, because medical science now knows that what we see with our eyes and hear with our ears is completely decided by what's known as the reticular activating system, which is the seat of the ego in the brain. And what we believe is what the brain allows our eyes to show us and our ears to hear. And I saw that demonstrated so clearly once when I was teaching a class on abundance. And I went to pick up a lady from the station, and we had to walk back to where my car was. And I saw, she was saying to me how she really needed a holiday, but she couldn't get a decent holiday and she wanted to go somewhere. And we were walking past the old-fashioned travel agent at the time. And there in the window was a holiday slashed to quarter price because they needed more people to take that holiday. So she could have gone away for 2 weeks for less than £200, which she could have afforded at that time. She didn't even see it. And when I pointed it out to her, she immediately said, oh, there's a catch to that. No, that's not going to happen. I'm not going to bother with that. And she never went on that holiday. I went back into that travel agent the next day, having found out that she wasn't going to buy that holiday. And I bought that holiday and it was good and above board. So you actually get what you can perceive. Okay, so that's your lesson for this evening. And I'm going to hand over to Bill, who was quite likely contradict quite a lot and add quite a little. No, quite add quite a little. Bill, do you have anything to add? He's looking for his
name. I've just found it. Good. Right. There's a legend, and I don't know whether it's Talmud or elsewhere, but when Abraham died, Ishmael and Isaac did get together and reconciled with each other, and arranged for his burial. And the other thing is that after Sarah had died, Abraham went in search of Hagar and remarried her, and they had six sons. He had six sons, more sons, by Hagar, who he brought up and sent to the East to teach the people of the East. And presumably, that would suggest that he was also involved in the Hindu, beginnings of Hinduism. And of course, you have the suggestion is that the word Brahma is a corruption of Abraham. So all these things are rather fanciful. They may or may not be true, but they're interesting legends.
They are. Yes. I heard that it was Ketubah who was sent, her children were sent to the East, and they got as far as Japan. And in fact, I went on a pilgrimage to Japan once where people were showing us Mogen David's, the Star of David, on posts outside the temples there, which they were thinking came from Ketubah, who was another of Abraham's wives.
Well, actually, that was the other name which Hagar had adopted.
Oh, right. So that's another. Oh, well, there you go.
It's the same person.
But doesn't it just go to show that we only have part of the picture, but it's still fascinating. Okay, anybody else got any questions? Did anything strike you as...
One other point.
Oh, sorry, Bill, yes, go on.
When Sarah died, he wanted to bury her in the land of Israel. And of course, he had the Hittites then. Hittites were very generous. They said, we'll give you a plot. But no, Abraham said, I want a proper title. I want to buy a plot.
Okay, yes, a title of land, yes.
To stake a claim for the land. To take it as a gift was not, would not have made it possible. He had to actually purchase it to capture the right.
And that's the same today. You purchase a plot of land, don't you, for a burial? And in fact, my friend Izzy Benjamin in South Africa, when his brother had to have a leg amputated, Izzy let him bury the leg in Izzy. He had bought himself a grave, and his brother's leg was buried in the grave because Orthodox Judaism says you must be buried with your entire body. So the leg had to be buried before Izzy's brother died. And in fact, it was Izzy's purchase of that grave that not only helped his brother, but it also meant that Izzy, who was a very strong anti-apartheid campaigner and was on the government's hit list, was allowed to leave South Africa because they trusted that because he bought a grave there, he intended to stay. So when he left on a holiday visa, they assumed he was coming back and he never did. There's another story from that which I will tell you because it's just another wonderful indication of how the Holy One uses us. Izzy, who is dead now, he was 4'11", tiny little man, and a black belt in judo, probably because he was a tiny little man. And one day he was walking home from Warren Kenton's group, which I attended. He told us this story the following week, and he was walking across Hammersmith Bridge in London, and there was a black guy on the bridge who was going to jump off, and Izzy sort of went up to him and said, please don't do this. And the guy let him close because he was a big black guy, he was more than 6 foot tall, and he thought a 4'11" little wizened old Jewish guy isn't going to be able to stop me jumping. But Izzy was a black belt, so he overpowered the man, and when he was sitting on his stomach, the man said to him, you can't possibly understand what I've gone through, the racism I've gone through. And he said, really? I'm an anti-apartheid campaigner from South Africa, so yes, I can. And in fact, the guy's parents had heard of Izzy. And the guy, his name was Kurt, started attending Warren's group and is now one of the people who leads it. You know, so that's how the Holy One will work, if you will let him.
Yes. Actually, there's an interesting story mentioned by Viktor Frankl about how he was phoned up in the middle of the night by one of his patients who said, I can't take any more, I'm going to commit suicide, but I thought I'd let you know. Frankl spent the next 3 hours reasoning with him, giving all the reasons why he should not commit suicide. And finally, the fellow said, all right, I won't. I'll speak to you in the morning. In the morning, Dr. Frankel spoke to him and said, what was the argument that I put forward to you that changed your mind? He said, none of your arguments. What convinced me was that if a person could actually spend the whole night just listening to me like that, then this must be a world worth living in.
Yes, that's beautiful. The majority of us really just need a good listening to. Lovely. Thank you, Bill. Anyone got any comments, questions? Lovely. Okay, well, I'll stop the recording and send it off to you, and I can probably do that without...